Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Mark Thompson, and also featuring my co-host, Labour blogger Emma Burnell.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Good, thank you. I forgot to mention I'm a Lib Dem blogger, but most people listening to this will know that. And also,
it'll be fairly obvious fairly quickly as soon as
We start talking about electoral reform, it will be obvious. Also, I just wanted to mention that we're sort of on a summer break at the moment. So we had the first of our summer special one-off podcasts last week. But we're sort of just both around this week, and then I'm going to be away for another few weeks. So we thought we'd squeeze a normal one into the middle of the off-season. And there are a few stories to talk about as well, even though it is sort of the silly season. Some of these stories are a bit silly, but some of them are deadly serious. And I would say one of the most serious, if not the most serious, is the racist van story that has been covered quite a lot. So basically what some elements of the government have done, and we'll come to this in a minute, exactly what elements of the government it is. There's been some kind of pilot scheme where six vans with big billboards on them have been driving around certain areas of London with a message that I could probably summarise as go home to immigrants who are here illegally, according to what the government is saying. Emma, I've probably caricatured that slightly, but I don't think I've caricatured it too much.
They text home to the number.
Yeah.
So it's not, I wouldn't say that was too much of a caricature. No, it's horrible, isn't it? I mean, it's just hideous. I don't think the audience for that van is in fact illegal immigrants, let's face it. The audience for that ban is UKIP voters who the Tories are trying to appeal to.
But the crazy thing is, though, Nigel Farage has come out and said that that's too rich for his blood and that he wouldn't have done that and he thinks it's wrong.
Absolutely. And I very, very, very rarely agree with Nigel Farage, but on this case, he's absolutely spot on. But certainly, I mean, you know, this is classic Crosby, isn't it? I mean, it's just nasty, 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 dirty politics of exactly, you know, this is basically the are you thinking what we're thinking writ large. And it's just horrible. And you know, you're talking about the kind of intimidation of people, people who are very, very vulnerable, and the kind of intimidation that won't simply stay with the people they're trying to intimidate, but will create much more of a culture of separation, of nastiness, of, you know, racism. It is I'm just shocked beyond belief by this, by the cynicism of it, as well as just how disgraceful it is. And the fact that a government in 2013 of any political stripe is doing this is beyond belief.
Do you think it's at all justifiable? Because I think one of us going to have to take a slight devil's advocate position just for a minute, because I think we're just going to both agree for the next 10 minutes otherwise. So just to test this slightly, is there not an argument for saying that putting out information about how people who want to know how the government can help them go back to their country of origin and just make that slightly easier for them with a text, you know, a text service, and making it clear that the government is able to help them if that's what people want to do? I mean, do you not think there's any argument for saying in some way this could be justified?
No, it's not there to do that. Let's see how much take up they get from genuine illegal immigrants rather than the people who've decided to wind it up.
Well, I think from what I've read so far, one person.
There you go. I'm sure all the thousands and millions of pounds being spent on this, for that one person to text them, it's completely worth it, and in no way makes up for the racist and nasty oppressive culture that these vans are subjecting people to.
You think the fact that they're focusing on specific London boroughs as well tells a story?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, London boroughs where there are competitive races for the Conservatives, yeah, I think it tells a bit of a story.
Do you think that's what's driving it then?
Well, I think there are people driving the vans, but I think it's political. It's absolutely nothing to do with Home Office policy. It's nothing to do with, you know, government policy. It's not something they've done because they want to achieve a policy outcome. It's something they've done because they want to achieve a political outcome. And I hope it spectacularly backfires on them. I have more faith in this country than Lynch and Crosby does, possibly because I'm not an immigrant like Lyndon Crosby, but actually most of the immigrants I met have more patriotic than most British people. But I just find it so horribly, nastily cynical. It's so depressing. And I just hope that people respond to it in the same way that I do.
Well, I think it already is backfiring because I haven't really seen much, if any, commentary, even from people on the right who are saying that they think this is a good thing. I've seen some commentary from the right that has been trying to analyse what the Conservatives are trying to achieve with this and has given it, I think, a fair wind from that perspective. But I haven't really seen any commentary that said this is a great thing, this is a brilliant idea, you know, good on them. I don't think anyone really seems to think that. I think everyone can recognise a dog whistle when they hear stroke see one.
Everyone in the bubble can, yeah. Whether it's having a broader impact outside, I don't know. I don't think it's aimed at political commentators.
No, well, it's not aimed at me because I don't live in London, so I haven't seen them driving around.
Well, I do live in London, but not in a seat the Tories are competitive, so I haven't seen it either.
Well, I think another interesting aspect of this from a kind of Lib Dem perspective is, and I've been trying to read the runes and trying to understand how this has happened, because the Lib Dems are completely and utterly against this. I mean, they've been very clear in public about that. Clear Clegg's come out, other senior ministers have come out. And yet somehow in a government that consists of, you know, Lib Dem ministers in lots of departments, that somehow this was just able to come out and there was no discussion with Clegg or with anyone else about it, and it just happened. And the best that the Lib Dems can now do is kind of appear to be shouting from the sidelines about how terrible this is, but they weren't able to do anything to stop it. And that, for me, calls into question what kind of mechanisms there are in place within government to make sure that there is buy-in from across the government for this sort of thing. Because it's definitely not in the coalition agreement, and if any Lib Dem had been asked about it and had had, you know, the chance to say yay or nay, we'd have said nay.
Yeah, not exactly the most coalitious moments.
No, not at all.
And you're quite right. It does call into question what the coalition is all about and whether there is a genuine coalition, or if the Tories can just do what they want, what are the Lib Dems going to do about it? Because, you know, as we know and as we've discussed many times, you're not going to leave government. So why shouldn't the Tories trample all over you to prove that they can?
I'm wondering if it's because the particular department that was dealing with this within the Home Office didn't have a Lib Dem minister.
So shouldn't it have gone through something like the Quad? Or...
yeah, but then I wonder if the criteria for what does and doesn't go through the Quad, because you early on said, you know, the millions of pounds spent on this. Actually, it was £10,000 that was spent on this.
I was slightly exaggerating but
sure. But the reason why I'm highlighting that is because maybe that just means it comes below the radar, and you know, within whatever department it's within, you know, maybe if it was 100,000 or a million, that would trigger some kind of, hang on a minute, we need to make sure we get Lib Dem buy-in for this. I don't know the answer to this question, and I am going to try and find out, because I want to understand how this was able to happen, and frankly, whether it's going to happen again, you know, not this exact thing, but other things that the Lib Dems wouldn't be happy with. Because I just wonder how happy the Tories would be if some department that has a Lib Dem minister suddenly just did something like this and called it a pilot, in quotes, but was something that, you know, was really pushing the Lib Dem political agenda and was going to help the Lib Dems in certain seats, or at least the Lib Dems might perceive it might help them in certain seats. And whether the Tories would just roll over and say, yeah, no problem, you get on with it. I suspect not, in which case there's a pretty big imbalance in how these things are being triggered and how they're being worked through.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But as I say, if I were a Tory minister and wanted to do something this horrible, I would not feel that the Lib Dems could stop me, because I know that they're not going to stand up to me.
I mean, the truth is that Lib Dems have stopped quite a lot of things that the Tories would have liked to have done. But this is one, and I know in the past we've talked about this and you've said, yeah, but the public aren't going to know what you have and haven't stopped, so it's not going to be much of a campaigning thing. And, you know, we could argue about that, but they definitely have stopped some things. But this is an example of something where they definitely would have stopped them if they'd have known about it, but they didn't even know about it.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, but what I'm saying is it's not going to break the coalition, is it? You're not going to come out coalition over it. No. So what sanction will there be?
I think the only sanction that there is, as far as I can see, is that Lib Dems are very vocally and very loudly protesting about it. But that kind of makes them look a bit impotent.
Yeah, exactly. Which is this is the problem. If I were in a Tory ministry right now and I wanted to do something I knew the Lib Dems would hate, watching what's happened with this would make me think, well, OK, that's clearly something you can just get away with.
It doesn't set a very good precedent. And no. I think if it starts to happen more and more, then I think there really will be serious questions raised at, you know, the top level of the Lib Dems as to what is happening here. I don't think it, in and of itself, this one occurrence will break the coalition. But if it keeps happening in the end, I can't imagine that the Lib Dems are just going to sit back and say, right, yeah, fine. Because that it just looks absolutely terrible. And it looks like the Lib Dems are enabling, like you say, frankly racist racist policies to be piloted, I'll put it in quotes again, because I think it's I think it's a bit rich to say it's a pilot. The amount of coverage that they've had out of this, I think it's quite clear that it's more than just an attempt to see whether something works. And if the figures that we're seeing are true, it hasn't worked anyway, so it's a failed pilot as far as I can tell. Okay, well, there is a risk that we're just going to agree for another 5 minutes if we carry on, but I am going to be very interested to, Lib Dem conference in a few weeks' time. I'll try and see if I can collar some senior Lib Dems and see if I can find out what their thoughts are on this. And just see if they've got any ideas about how they can stop it from happening in future. Okay, the next thing we thought we would talk about is that Carolyn Criado Perez, who is an activist online, and also offline as well, helped lead a campaign over the last few months in order to make sure that there was a woman on British banknote, because after some changes that were being proposed by the Bank of England, it was actually going to be that there would be no women depicted on British banknotes, apart from the Queen, of course. But that was its own separate debate, and the Queen's not there for reasons of merit, she's there because she's the sovereign. And it was a successful campaign because the Bank of England, Mark Carney, the new governor of the Bank of England, came out and said that, yes, Jane Austen was going to be on, I think, the new £10 note.
Yeah.
So a very successful campaign. Great. Then what happened is that Carolyn started to be subjected to what can only be described as vile abuse on Twitter, where various men, and I think it was all men, tweeted at her various terribly misogynistic comments, threats of rape, all kinds of just horrible, horrible stuff. I have read a few of them. I'm not going to repeat them here, but it was horrible stuff. And it went on and on and on. And then she tried to complain to Twitter about it. And I think the initial advice was that she should just block these people. But there seemed to be some kind of coordination going on, because there were hundreds and hundreds of these things being tweeted at her. And it just becomes overwhelming. There comes a point where you can't just keep blocking all these people because it's not practicable. And now there's a question over whether Twitter should have a much easier mechanism for allowing people to report this sort of abuse. What are your thoughts about this, Emma? Have you ever been subjected to this sort of thing on Twitter yourself? I have to say I haven't, but I'm a man. I'm a man, so maybe that's why I haven't.
Yeah, I have. I've been told that I'm too ugly to rape, so why do I care about such an issue? I've been threatened. I've been sidelined and told that I'm stupid for caring about female representation, sometimes by fellow Labour Party members.
Has this all been online?
Yeah. I get comments on my blog that I don't publish, commenting on my appearance and threatening me, which I just delete rather than publish, but they come in. I mean, I'm not as high profile as Caroline, and I haven't won as brilliant a victory as she has. But it does happen when you have a profile as a female blogger, as a female person online.
So would you say that this is actually, I mean, I hate to use the word, but is this normal for female bloggers and activists online to just
suffer
this stuff?
I don't know a single woman who does what I do who doesn't get this kind of abuse to some level or another.
And how kind of frequently are we talking? Is it like daily, weekly, monthly?
For me, it's probably weekly. For more high-profile women, say like Laurie Penny or Ellie Mayer Hagen, it's probably much more frequently than that. Helen Lewis, I think, gets it almost every day.
Mm. So what do you think about these proposals for Twitter having mechanisms to make it easier to report this sort of thing?
Well, Twitter needs to be prepared to invest in making that happen well, because, I mean, the problem is that an abuse button could easily be abused. Mm. And someone who is simply disagreeing with you politically or doesn't enjoy your work as a comedian or as a writer or what have you could just as easily be blocked as somebody who is being genuinely threatening.
Yeah. I saw a blog post, I think it was from Jenny Rigg, Lib Dem activist who we've had on this podcast before, actually, who did a post about this. She was saying that the problem is that trolls see this as a game. So if you put things, you know, barriers in their way, they'll just find ways of using those barriers to their own advantage. And probably a little bit like what you said there, that if you have a button that is reporting this kind of abuse, then realistically Twitter probably isn't going to review every single tweet that you report. Instead, what it will just be triggered by a certain number, say 10 or 15 or 20 or whatever threshold they put in place, you know, of different accounts that report another account for this sort of thing, and then the account will just be closed down probably automatically once it reaches that threshold. So you could imagine a situation where someone who's determined enough could just set up a load of different accounts and then just complain about the one account that they are themselves trolling, and then that account will get closed down and it will cause that person probably damage in that way. So I think...
Yeah, I mean, I'm really torn over this because I think that's an excuse rather than a reason. Do you know what I mean? Like, Twitter won't do it well, so therefore we shouldn't consider doing it. It's not good enough for me. Quite often the analogy used, I wrote about this yesterday, of the internet is the Wild West. Mm. Unlawful, ungovernable. But the thing about the Wild West is it doesn't exist anymore. You know, it did get tamed. And we shouldn't give up just because things are difficult. We need to have a culture that recognises the importance of investing in safe spaces. We need to have a culture that recognises the importance of giving women an equal platform where they feel that they can have their say without being threatened with rape.
But is the problem, though, a specifically online thing? Because, and I can't really imagine it happening that often where a woman might be in a pub talking about something and suddenly a load of men crowd around her and start threatening to rape her. That generally doesn't happen. So do you think there's something about the internet, the fact that there's a certain level of anonymity afforded, that some men just think they can get away with this sort of thing then?
Have you ever read the Everyday Sexism website, Mark? Because every single day women are threatened in ways that feel like you're being silenced, like you're being put into a particular position.
Yeah.
You go to a club, you may not be threatened with rape for having an opinion, but you'll certainly be told you're a bitch if you don't allow someone to grope you. Mm. You will be called all sorts of names if you say, I really don't want you to do that, thank you very much. You know, the assumption that you are there for the pleasure of men is everywhere. I can't walk down my street. Week in, week out, this happens without someone feeling that they have the right to come and ask me out and get very pushy when I say no and walk me to my door so they can see where I live whilst harassing me, despite the fact that I've made it very clear that I'm not interested. Mm. And you know, this is the space we live in. It's not just an online problem. The online anonymity makes it easier and makes it more extreme at times, but it's not. This is a cultural problem everywhere.
Yeah, no, I have read the Everyday Sexism website, and I've certainly seen a lot of the tweets. You know, every now and then, the Everyday Sexism hashtag kind of flares up, and you get lots and lots of examples. And some of the examples I've seen of that are horrific. You know, that happen in the offline world. I wasn't really trying to say that you don't get examples of sexism in the offline world. It was more that the specific type of hounding where you suddenly get, you know, dozens or hundreds of men attacking one particular person. I don't think it quite happens in the same way, but of course what you're saying is right, that it happens in other ways that are maybe just as horrendous, but it just doesn't follow precisely the same dynamic. And I think that's kind of what I was getting at, which is that this isn't an online problem specifically. In fact, what's happening is that the online world is reflecting what happens in the offline world.
Yeah, I would say that is true.
So if we're going to try and fix this problem, do we need just a bigger cultural change in order to try and stop this from happening, rather than trying to retrofit technological fixes to a problem, those fixes themselves of which will have their own inherent problems too?
I don't think it's an either-or question. I think we have to change our culture because our culture is broken. In the meantime, we have to protect ourselves against the worst aspects of that culture. And the problem for me is I completely get that we don't have the technology to do this right now. completely get that, which is why I find a lot of the discussion about things like porn filters and blocking buttons a bit simplistic. But for me, when did technology people become the can't do people? You know, when did that happen? Why are we not imagining a better way of doing it? Why are people who have the, you know, the equipment, the talent, the skills to try and think about this, instead of becoming defensive about the openness of the internet, actually applying their talent to trying to make this a better place?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I have a bit of an insight into that because I, you know, one of the things that I do in my non-political world is I program computers, and I have been doing for many years. And I think I sort of understand why it happens like this, because it is so difficult for computers to make judgments about things. And that's really what you're asking them to do. You know, to try and just, I have written algorithms to try and process quite complex data, but it tends to be mathematical, the kind of mathematical sphere that I've focused on. If I was trying to write software that was supposed to parse text and try and work out whether something was, you know, offensive or whether something's sarcastic, whether someone really means it, that gets very tricky. I actually remember reading something a couple of weeks ago about some piece of software that was actually had been written to detect sarcasm, and apparently it had an 80% success rate. But as far as I'm concerned, unless it's almost 100%, it's almost useless. Because just because it's 80% sounds really good, but that means 20% of things that are sarcastic aren't going to get picked up by this processing engine. And when you're talking about, say, a billion tweets, that means that it might pick up 800 million of them, but it won't pick up 200 million of them. And it's such a difficult problem to crack that's why I think if Twitter was going to implement a solution to this, it would require human eyes on every single tweet. And then, of course, those human eyes would have their own prejudices and their own biases and their own subjectivity bringing to the table. And any computer program you write, even if you could make it sophisticated enough, there would still be biases within the code of the computer program. So I can understand why the instinctive reaction of tech people is to say this can't be done, this is too difficult, because it is. Not because in 20 years' time it won't be necessarily be impossible. It might be possible at that point, but I do think we're a long way away from computers being able to, with enough confidence, be able to process this stuff.
Yeah, but I'm just tired of the instant we can't, and therefore let's not even talk about it. There just seems to be such a bias towards either we can't or we shouldn't. You know, the libertarian aspects of the internet, protecting the right of men to threaten rape rather than protecting the right of a woman not to be threatened. You know, a huge misunderstanding of what free speech actually is. I just would like to see a slightly different focus on the conversation. Just move it on a bit to how could we? Let's get the brightest and best minds in this area working together on how this could work, rather than simply saying, oh, it can't work, so let's do something else.
Well, just to come to, because when you were just talking a couple of minutes ago, you mentioned about the porn filters, and that was something else that I also wanted to talk about, and it's kind of related to this area, at least in terms of, you know, we're talking about blocking and, you know, opt-in and opt-out and all of that stuff. So, I mean, David Cameron came out on the record last week or the week before, and he said that he does want a situation where the internet service providers, that when you're signing up with them, that there is actually an opt-in thing, so that you actually have to explicitly say, yes, I want to access adult material. And that if you don't explicitly say that, then you won't get that information or access to those websites. And therefore, by default, and I think this is the key phrase, by default, people signing up with internet service providers won't get access to adult material. And that has caused quite a lot of consternation within kind of, you know, the liberal community, the libertarian community, and quite a lot of people who I wouldn't necessarily describe as either of those things seem to have a problem with it as well. What do you think about that? It sounds like, from what you were saying, Emma, that you're okay with this idea that by default you won't get access to adult material. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that there are two separate issues. There's the philosophical issue, and then there's the technological issue. And they've become very melded together. So will it work? Probably not. should it work? Yeah, why not? I mean, you know, we do restrict things in our culture. You know, there are age restrictions on certain films and video games and what have you for good reasons, because while people are developing, they're not necessarily ready to cope with hardcore pornography. I remember finding a porn mag when I was 10 and being absolutely terrified of it. Genuinely the most frightened I've ever been at that point in my life.
And you know, let me guess, was it in some bushes by a railway siding?
No, it was round the back of Clissold Park.
Okay.
You can get it at Clissold Park these days, it's far nicer now.
No, it's just, it always seemed to be when I was a kid, that you always used to find porn mags like in a Tesco carrier bag stashed down the side of some railway sidings. Maybe it's because I lived quite near a lot of railway sidings. But
that might have had something to do with it, yeah. I mean, basically there was a bit of wild trees at the back of my local park, which is where we found this thing. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that the I don't have a problem with a certain amount of opting in rather than opting out. You know, I'm not a libertarian. I believe that the state has a right to protect citizens as much as it has a right for citizens to be protected from the state being overweening. And I think that on balance, this is an okay thing to do. I don't think kids should be exposed to pornography. I'm not anti-porn at all. I genuinely have no problem with pornography. I'd like to see the industry be safer, better, cleaner and more well-adjusted, more diverse, better catering to a female audience. But that's a different matter. But I have no problem with pornography. I just do not think it's something that should be openly available to children. And again, you know, whether these measures that David Cameron's talking about will work in terms of the technology is a different question from whether they should work.
Well, I mean, in terms of will they work, and I've got a very specific example of when they really didn't work in my case. It was when I was in hospital a lot, about a year or two ago, and I wanted access to the website politicalbetting.com, which, although it's got betting in the title, is actually really more about analysis of politics. It will occasionally give you odds and stuff on things because that is one of its focuses, but it's a completely, you know, innocuous website. And I couldn't get access to it on my mobile phone, which was with one of the mobile phone providers. And I actually ended up having to call up my phone provider, wait in a queue for 20 minutes, get put through to someone. I then explained the situation and they said, well, they could take the block off, but it would take 24 hours to come through. And they did, and in the end, I mean, he got a bit shirty with me, actually. I think I was a bit frustrated having waited for 20 minutes, but I tried to be polite. But yeah, it wasn't an easy phone call. It didn't just happen automatically. It took a bit of discussion. And then eventually they did take the block off. It took more than 24 hours. It was like 48 hours, I think, before I could access it. And it was quite frustrating for me because I really, you know, I'm an adult. I had to be an adult to have signed up to that contract, you know, just because of the way those contracts work. You can't sign up to them if you're a minor. So I really didn't see why that should have been turned off by default. And it wasn't that straightforward to get it turned back on again. It was a pain in the arse. And so I did have a problem with that. But maybe that falls into this category of what you're saying, that maybe political betting shouldn't have been covered. And maybe if the filters were cleverer, then it wouldn't have been covered. Because it's not like I was trying to download hardcore pornography on my phone. Yeah. That's not what I was trying to do. I was trying to just get access to something that I didn't really feel should have been blocked. But it was. And that is definitely a problem. And it's more than just, you know, political websites that have a betting flavour to them. There are all kinds of websites that get blocked. And I think it's in many ways it's more serious than that, because websites that deal with things like, you know, transgender issues and lesbian and gay issues, they will sometimes get blocked because it appears that the content on those websites is for an adult-only audience. Whereas you could imagine someone who's 13 or 14 trying to come to terms with their own sexuality and wants to get access to those websites, probably doesn't want to tell the mum and dad about it because they just want to find out more about it. And if those kind of websites were blocked too, and they regularly are, is my understanding, then, you know, that's problematic in itself. I don't think you're ever going to get a perfect situation where all the websites that are in the blocked list, everyone unanimously agrees should be blocked, and all the ones that aren't, you know, fall into a category that everyone's happy with. There's always going to be grey areas here, and I'm just not sure a filter like that is ever going to be able to cope with it properly.
I think there are always going to be grey areas, but that's, you know, where political negotiation comes in. But I, again, it's, you know, we're conflating should it happen and could it happen? And I, you know, could it happen right now? No, probably not. Should it happen? Yes, probably. How do we go from it can't happen to it does happen? It's not a not what we're asking ourselves, and that's what we should be asking ourselves.
But that's not quite right, though, is it? Because what's happening is that the government, in the form of the Prime Minister, is saying these opt-in, opt-out things are going to happen because he's going to make it happen. I think he said the ISPs have got a year to find a way to make this work, otherwise the government will legislate and force it to happen.
Yeah.
We're not going to be in a position where this stuff is anywhere near sophisticated enough to take into account all these nuances. And actually, I repeat my point, I don't think it ever will, because I don't think it's a purely technological problem. I think there will always be some people who will think kids shouldn't have access to websites that talk about homosexuality. There will just be always people that think that.
But there will be, but they're not going to be in a massive majority, are they? I mean, even most people who are a little bit homophobic would probably be okay with people being able to read about homosexuality.
Well, again, we come and actually, I don't think that the way this is done at the moment is right either, because it just seems to be companies just have a department, and that department is full of people who just decide yes, no, yes, no, yeah, that one can be in the block list, that one isn't in the block list. There's no accountability for this. So I think we really do have to have a much better way of determining this list. I mean, I'll cards on the table, I'm very, very uncomfortable with this whole opt-in, opt-out thing. You know, I think if someone signs up with their ISP and they say, I do not want this connection to have any access to any adult content, then fine. And that mechanism already exists. The idea that by default that will happen and you have to say, please, sir, please, can I have some porn, please? That, I really don't like that. I think that is kind of a violation of people's rights, really.
So I come at this from another angle. I don't think it's a violation of people's rights. If before the internet existed, if you wanted porn, you would have to go and buy porn.
No, you just go down to your local railway sidings.
Well, okay, but you'd still be seeking it out.
Yeah, no, fair point, okay.
You know, and I don't think the fact that porn is more freely available makes the fact that we should seek it out rather than have it enforced upon us a different philosophical question.
Hang on a sec, you say forced upon us. I mean, I don't think anyone's advocating porn should be forced upon people.
Well, I think that, okay, it's certainly easier to, for example, a group of young children showing each other pornography when one may not be keen to be involved. That is the kind of situation. But, I mean, okay, the availability of pornography has led to a pornified culture, a culture in which pornographic images are common. We all know what the porn tropes are. You know, we may not watch it ourselves, or we may watch it ourselves, but we recognise the porn tropes. Friends, one of the biggest shows in the world, did a sitcom that entirely revolved around porn tropes. Did one episode with, you know, lots and lots of in-jokes about what happens in pornography. So we are all very, very aware of porn in a way that we probably weren't, say, 20 years ago before the internet happened.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really argue with that. And the idea that children are going to, you know, sharing stuff in the playground, I mean, that happened anyway. You know, my first exposure to pornography was pages from magazines being passed around in the playground. I think it was ever thus, certainly, you know, when I was a kid, and probably a generation or so before, you know, ever since photographs and magazines have been published, really. I mean, whether or not this stuff is now more freely available, I don't think there's any doubt that it is. And like I say, you know, if I had a child and they had a mobile phone or an internet connection, I would want to institute filters. Now, maybe I'm in a privileged position because I'm technically savvy enough to be able to do all that stuff myself, probably at the firewall level, you know, and I could probably, you know, set it up to specifically block any site that I wanted if I so chose. So I certainly think adults should have the right to be able to do that, but it feels too blunt to have the Prime Minister basically force ISPs to make this happen by default for everyone. I am very uncomfortable with that, and I think it's partly principle and it's partly practical. You know, maybe if we lived in a perfect world where the technology was such that actually it could make these informed decisions much better, maybe I'd be less reluctant. But as it is, we ain't there yet, and we ain't going to be there for a long time.
No, we're not. But the technology, this is the thing, is we keep conflating these two things, as I've said before. And I would like to separate out those conversations and take the technological one and say, how do we make it work properly? And then I think we could have a more practical, more interesting conversation about these things, rather than simply saying, won't work, shouldn't work.
Yeah. Well, maybe this is one for the moral maze. That's what they often do on that Radio 4 programme, where they try and separate out the practical and the principle and then just debate it purely on the level of principle. Maybe I'm so ensconced in the technological side that I just find that impossible on this particular issue. Okay.
Whereas I'm a complete technophobe, so I'm okay.
Well, you're in that kind of happy, luxurious position of being able to think about the principle side of it without worrying about the practicalities too much.
What you're saying is I'm happy idiot.
That's Emma, that is your phrase, not mine. Okay. The other thing we thought we might talk about today is the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, made some comments a few days ago, which I think perhaps surprised some people, because he specifically picked out a payday lending company, Wonga, and he said that I can't remember the exact phrase, but it was something like the country would be better if Wonga wasn't there, and that although he wouldn't ban them, he wants to outcompete them.
Yeah.
By setting up credit unions.
Compete them out of business, he said.
Yeah, compete them out of business by use of credit unions backed by the Church of England, which all sounded well and good. And then about a day later, someone from the Financial Times did some sniffing around and found out that about £75,000 or £100,000 of the Church of England's £5.2 billion in investments had been invested in a company. If I got this right, I think it was an American-based company that had helped Wonga with some fundraising a few years ago.
Right.
So suddenly he was being accused of hypocrisy. Apparently this was terribly embarrassing for him, for the Church of England. Fair play to him. He came straight out and said, hands up, it is embarrassing. But, you know, now this has been exposed, we'll change how we invest, or we'll do our best to change how we invest. And he didn't back down from his position at all and said that we're still going to do our best to try and outcompete Wonga. What do you think about this, Emma?
I think it's a good thing. I would like to see payday lenders driven out of business by better, more ethical lenders. I think any raising of the profile of credit unions has got to be a good thing. They are a much, much better way of ensuring good, ethical lending to the kinds of people who are forced at the moment down the payday loan route. I think the whole embarrassment thing was just such a nonsense, really. I mean, it's such 6 degrees of separation. I think he did react very well to it. I don't always agree with Justin Welby. We would disagree over, for example, gay marriage. Quite possibly disagree over institutionalised religion. But on this occasion, I think he's spot on, and good on him.
Yeah, I mean, the embarrassment in quotes thing really pissed me off, because if you've got £5.2 billion in investments, it's, I would say, impossible to be sure that somewhere along the line, some of that investment, you know, if it's spread widely, and as it should be, if you've got £5.2 billion and it's being held in trust for the Church of England, you really should make sure those investments are spread widely.
Yeah.
Then it's pretty much impossible that you won't at some point have invested in a company that has had some dealings with Wonga or one of the payday lenders, or some other company that has dubious ethics. I mean, I think I saw some coverage on the news where it was saying that in some circumstances, the Church of England's investments are permitted to be invested in gambling and in pornography. But when they actually talked about it, they said, well, it might be a hotel chain that allows, gambling to happen on its premises, or it might be, a hotel chain that allows people to watch pornographic films in their bedroom. It's pretty much impossible to avoid that. So it really annoyed me, because it really felt like some journalist, aha, we found a way to now make it to turn this story into Justin Welby is a hypocrite, as if Justin Welby had any say in how that money was invested. It happened years ago before he was Archbishop of Canterbury. And it's this thing that you see happen again and again, when it happens with The Guardian as well. The Guardian campaign about tax justice, but then it turns out that the way that some of their money is invested is done in a tax efficient way, and suddenly they're not allowed to even talk about it, when actually the reason why they're having to invest it in that way is because that's what all their competitors do, and if they didn't, they'd be at a competitive disadvantage. Whereas if the rules and the law was such that no one could do it, then they wouldn't do it, and they'd probably be quite happy with that. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit on my soapbox here, but it just pisses me off when people are accused of hypocrisy over things that they have very little control over. So putting that to one side, I'm not sure I am comfortable with the Church of England trying to push its morality in this way on other people. If they want to set up credit unions, if those credit unions do very well, then that's fine. But it rankles with me a little bit, I think, because of the privileged position that the Church of England is in. that they, when they start getting involved with politics, because that really is what this is, I find that a little bit, I don't know, it doesn't sit easily with me, let's put it that way. I'm not sure I can totally rationalise it, but I don't really like it. I'm not sure that it should be coming from a church leader, really. This should be coming from politicians. And I know there are some politicians who've done sterling work in this area. Stella Creasy for Labour is one obvious example where she's really campaigned in this area. And fair play to her. I wonder if the Church of England is stepping in because they just feel that the politicians haven't done a good enough job with this stuff, in which case it's a political failing that's leading to this.
Well, I mean, the first thing you said was that you didn't think that the Church of England should be opposing their morality. I think they're arguing their morality. They are in the business of morality. That's what religion's all about, is saying that there is a particular moral code that you should live your life by.
But as you've already pointed out, that moral code often extends in areas that both you and I would completely oppose, like
absolutely. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't have a right to their voice. It just means that we should also have a right to oppose them when we do.
Maybe, like I say, I'm not sure I can totally rationalise it. It's maybe my kind of, you know, atheist and anti-establishment kind of deep-seated core asserting itself in a way that I can't quite articulate. It just, I don't know, I don't like it when I see church people getting on the telly and telling us what to do.
Bishops in the House of Lords.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a privileged position that they get simply by dint of their religion.
Mm.
I do think that a bishop has a right to an opinion and should express that opinion in public.
Yeah, but it's a little bit like the Jed Bartlett human starting gun thing, isn't it? I mean, okay, so fine. He's talking about payday lenders, and I don't like payday lenders, and I think the country would be a better place if credit unions took the place of them with much better interest rates and actually taking into account the well-being of the people they're lending to much more, which I think they do. And that's fine. But then when he stands up next week or next month or next year and spouts off about something I completely disagree with him about, he's still that human starting gun. He's still using that same privileged position to push his church's agenda. And I think they get disproportionate coverage. I think for precisely the reasons you said, they are the establishment church. They have however many it is, 18 bishops or something in the House of Lords. And I think all that is completely wrong. You know, I think if the leader of another religion stood up and made similar comments, it wouldn't get anything like as much coverage. And I just... That's what sits ill with me, because they have this privileged position. So when they're campaigning on something I agree with, great, but I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't also acknowledge that I don't in principle like them doing that full stop.
Well, I mean, it's not like they actually managed to stop gay marriage, for example. So, you know, we're talking about people expressing an opinion that other people can then make up their minds on. I don't like what Justin Welby had to say about gay marriage. I do like what he has to say about payday lenders. I would argue for his right to say both.
Okay, well, I'm going to go off slightly on a tangent here, but I'll give you an example of where the church doing what the church does has actually directly affected something that I think is completely wrong. So when they decided a few months ago that they weren't going to allow women bishops, that means that those bishops that are in the House of Lords can never be women. So that there is a specific cohort within the House of Lords, specific slice of the House of Lords, that cannot, by law, be female. And that, to me, is completely wrong. So it's an example of where the church pushing their agenda and pushing, you know, their morals and their ethics actually does push it on everyone else.
Yes, but we're talking about, you know, we both agree that there shouldn't be bishops on the House of Lords. We both said that. There's a difference between where they should be in terms of our democracy and whether they should be allowed to speak out within our democracy.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of onion peeling exercise, this, isn't it? Because I don't think there should be bishops in the House of Lords, full stop. And I actually don't think there should be a House of Lords, full stop. I think the House of Lords should be elected. And then I would want it to be elected by STV with multi-member constituencies. So maybe we should stop before I peel.
So there you go. We're proving your Lib Demery.
There we go. It's taken almost the entire podcast to get there. But I managed to find a route
got
to
there
it.
At the end.
I did indeed. Okay, well... is there anything else to say on this issue? I mean, do you think that actually Welby will ultimately, maybe in years to come, be successful in this? Do you think it is possible for credit unions to outcompete payday lenders so that they don't exist in, say, 5 or 10 years time?
I think it's certainly theoretically possible. I think they need a big injection of finance and we need a cultural shift. But I think that the harsh light that is being shone on payday lenders at the moment, if that's kept up, I think we are going to see a shift in how this kind of emergency finance is dealt with.
Yeah. Okay. Good stuff. All right. Well, we'll probably leave it there then. So it just remains for me to thank my co-host Emma, and we will now both be away for a few weeks and be back at the end of August to resume business as usual. Just before we do go, actually, is it worth us highlighting the people that we've got coming up in the one-off podcast over the next few weeks? Because we know who they are now because we've recorded.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you want to just mention the two people that you interviewed?
Yeah, I was very pleased. I got to have a really interesting chat with Isabel Hardman, who is the editor of the Coffee House blog at The Spectator, about the Tories and how they're feeling and how they're doing.
Yep.
And then equally a really interesting chat with Ian McNichol, who was General Secretary of the Labour Party, about the changes that Labour are making and his vision for Labour and going into the next election.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay, and I interviewed Ian Collins, LBC presenter, to cover kind of politics in general over the next year or two. But that one was already released last week. And then I have also interviewed Karen Lindsay, who is co-editor of Lib Dem Voice. And we talk Lib Demery for quite a long time. So I haven't edited that one down yet. I might have to edit some of it. It did go on quite a bit. And I think the order we're going to release is next week we'll release Emma talking to Isabel. The week after it'll be me talking to Karen. And then the final week it will be Emma talking to Ian. Well, they don't hold me to that, but that's the way I'm planning to release them. So I hope that everyone enjoys those. And like I say, we'll be back again at the end of August. And so it just remains for me to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd also like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back after the summer.